From WBUR Boston, I'm Gail Harris, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. 30 years ago this week in Cambodia, Pol Pot began one of the bloodiest, most ruthless dictatorships in history. Under his rule, the Khmer Rouge murdered more than a million Cambodians in the killing fields. Much is known about the brutality of Pol Pot's regime, but little is known about the man. Tonight on Point, we take a probing new look at the mastermind behind the horror. We go inside the life, mind, and legacy of Pol Pot. But first, the giant information broker LexisNexis announced today that up to 10 times as many people as originally thought may have had their profiles stolen from one of its U.S. databases. Last month, the company announced security breaches could have affected 32,000 consumers. Today, that number jumped to roughly 300,000. David Kolker covers technology for the Los Angeles Times and joins me now. David, welcome to you.
Thank you very much.
That's a pretty big jump, going from 32,000 to 300,000.
That is a huge jump, and it puts them in first place, a dubious distinction to be sure. Up until now, ChoicePoint Inc., an Atlanta-based company, had that record when they were saying approximately 145,000 records had been exposed. Now we get LexisNexis up to 310,000.
And what's behind the jump?
Well, what they're saying is that they bought a company called Sisint. That was a Florida company, a database company, back in September. They were integrated into their databases and started to see some suspicious actions. Back in March, they were saying that they had found 32,000 files that were possibly exposed. Then they said they went back in, did further looking, and it jumped up to 310,000. They said they have indeed notified those initial 32,000 people. They did find, during this look into Sisint, that in the regular LexisNexis files, there were also a couple relatively small infiltrations there. One of them goes back to January, and it seems the people in that one, it's really only about 20 people, but still it's interesting that none of those people were notified. LexisNexis says they're going to do that now.
And what kind of information was potentially stolen?
They're not saying exactly what it was. The kind of information that was in those databases are social security numbers, addresses, that sort of thing.
Well, the company is saying that the stolen data does not include personal credit histories, medical records, or financial records on individuals. But if, as you say, they did get Social Security and driver's license numbers, that doesn't seem like a large leap between that and being able to get that other information.
Well, my goodness, yes. A Social Security number plus a date of birth and a name and address is the mother's milk of identity thieves, unfortunately.
Do we know how they did it, how the hackers got in?
They are not saying. They're not talking, they're not discussing exactly how this happened. They are, in the case of the two much smaller breaches to LexisNexis, in one case they said an employee gave out it was supposed to be a trial password that, through some kind of electronic snafu, ended up to be a permanent password, and in another case they said there was a stolen password involved. As to what happened on the Sisint cases, they're not saying exactly what happened. Back on ChoicePoint, as you might recall, there were people who were using fake identities, which they had. These were identity thieves, and they had lots of sources for this sort of material. They were opening up accounts as if they were regular customers with ChoicePoint, and once you had an account, you could dig in and get a lot of database information.
What's the biggest implication of somebody having your Social Security and driver's license? Is it that they're going to open up credit card accounts in your name, or is it beyond that?
Well, they certainly can get a credit card, and once they have that, it's a very damaging thing, of course. The general pattern we found on the ChoicePoint cases is they would take this information, and they would then open in your name. They would get a mailbox someplace at, you know, these places that are available all over the place, these private mailbox places. They would change your address to that address, and then they would start ordering stuff, laptop, computers, whatever, and they would have them sent to that address. Once they had them, they would sell them or whatever they did with them, and until the person got a bill or started to see there was something unusual on their account, it just went on like that. And once this happens, unfortunately, as anyone who has had their identity stolen can tell you, it can go on for years before they get their credit history and all other identity matters straightened out.
Which I guess leads to the obvious question of, is there anything people can do to protect themselves?
you know, what the experts keep telling us is that you should get some kind of record of your credit report as often as possible. I guess even before that, the thing to do is to really check your bills carefully. I must say, I'm not as good about that as a lot of people, so I know how it can happen. But, you know, to really check your charges and so forth, to get a look at your credit report, to look for things that are unusual, and try to stop it early if it's indeed happened.
Sure. Save all those little pieces of paper. In just a minute or so we have left, David, some hearings tomorrow in Washington trying to deal with this?
Indeed. There is a Senate Judiciary Committee hearing. Senator Dianne Feinstein of California is on that committee. She has she introduced a bill actually just yesterday that would make it mandatory for information brokers, if they find that some of their files have been exposed, they have to notify people, and this is anywhere in the country. Currently, the only law that speaks to that is in my home state here of California. They've had the law on the books since 2003, but this would make it a national law. And in accordance with that, there are hearings of which there'll be executives from LexisNexis, from ChoicePoint, the chairman of the FTC will be there, someone from the FBI. They'll all be testifying.
David, thank you so much.
You bet.
David Kolker covers technology for the Los Angeles Times. He spoke with us from Los Angeles. On April 17, 1975, the Khmer Rouge marched into the Cambodian capital of Phnom Penh, captured the city, and then began one of the most brutal and ruthless dictatorial regimes in the history of the 20th century. Their leader was Pol Pot. 3 years into his rule, 1 million Cambodians were dead, exterminated by famine and murder at the hands of other Cambodians in the horrors of the killing fields. The nightmare Cambodia became began as a dream. Pol Pot's vision of a radically egalitarian utopia that could be achieved only by extreme social engineering, by the obliteration of old customs and ideas, by breaking the back of Cambodian society and the Cambodian people. 30 years later, blood and memory are still bound in Cambodia's soil. Tonight on Point, we take a probing new look at the mastermind behind the horror. We go inside the life, mind, and legacy of Pol Pot. And joining me now from the south of France is Philip Short, longtime foreign correspondent for the London Times, The Economist, and the BBC, based in Moscow, Washington, D.C., Uganda, and China. It was in China that Short had a chance to observe Pol Pot up close on the dictator's one and only official foreign visit outside Cambodia in 1977. Philip Short is also the author of one of the definitive biographies of Mao Zedong. His new book is Pol Pot, Anatomy of a Nightmare. And welcome, Philip Short, and thank you for a remarkable book.
Thank you, Gail.
Remind us, first of all, what happened in Cambodia 30 years ago and why Pol Pot was someone who you thought should be explained and written about.
It's a really interesting question because it's interesting to me because I spent four years of my life, nearly 5 years, trying to unravel what went on in this man's mind. And it's really very difficult because he was intensely secretive, he was reclusive, he operated behind layers of mystery, which he used very deliberately to hide his intentions. We do know that he started off, as many dictators have done, as an idealistic young man, as a student in Paris who had really the best at heart for his country. And then in the process of trying to bring about things which would improve life for Cambodians, he kind of got on a slippery slope, which in the course of which he took decisions and others around him took decisions which led them to onto a path which you can only really call the path of evil. And we really are dealing with two different things. We're dealing with the evil that resides in every human being and which in certain circumstances can become dominant, so that's a universal thing. And we are dealing with the specific circumstances of Cambodia, a small Asian country which to the outside world seemed a kind of, you know, a Shangri-La, an oriental paradise, but which was caught up in terrible contradictions between very powerful neighbors, which led to a sense of national paranoia about whether the Cambodians would survive. And these things played in to one another. The evil that Pol Pot certainly represented, the choices that he and others made, and the specific conditions of Cambodia in the middle of the 20th century.
Well, and it's interesting, too, because I think most of us tend to think of evil as being one-dimensional, and you paint a portrait of him as a boy and young man who had a perpetual smile. He was a fun-loving person.
Absolutely. No, I mean, you mentioned I met him in Beijing in 1977 on this one and only trip abroad, and he radiated an extraordinarily engaging personality. And if you like, the beginning of my fascination with Pol Pot and what made him tick and what caused this regime to be what it was the contrast, the contradiction between a man who was apparently such a winning personality and, on the other hand, the terrible stories which even then were already beginning to emerge from Cambodia. You know, how did you put these two together? And it's taken me a long time because 1977 is, getting on for 30 years ago, but that is what fundamentally motivated me to write the book.
Well, there is so much more to talk about. Philip Short, stay with us. We're going to take a brief break, and then we'll be back with more with Philip Short, author of a detailed new biography of Pol Pot, as we take a probing new look at the life and legacy of the brutal dictator and mastermind behind Cambodia's killing fields. Much more to come after the break. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we'll be right back. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking tonight about Pol Pot as we take a new look at the life and legacy of the brutal dictator and mastermind of Cambodia's killing fields. Our guest is longtime foreign correspondent Philip Short. He's the author of a gripping new biography, Pol Pot, Anatomy of a Nightmare, and he's joining us from the south of France. Philip, I want to pick up on just a little bit more of his younger years, because one of the things that I found so surprising was how you were able to connect the dots between the sort of unquestioning obedience and suppression of individuality that he experienced as a young man studying in a Buddhist monastery, and then that same obedience that he expected when he was ruling Cambodia.
Well, we are all products of the societies in which we grow up, and that certainly was the case with Pol Pot. A Buddhist monastery, indeed, schools in Cambodia generally, were extremely tough institutions. And you learnt as a child even more if you were a girl. Girls were even more required than young men in Cambodia to absolutely toe the line and to be respectful. They lived in a very feudal society. But Pol Pot was a product of that kind of society, and when he came to power, he expected, as you say, everybody to obey instinctively, without any kind of questioning. The policies he laid down. And one of the things I encountered most often talking, because I spent several years interviewing former Khmer Rouge leaders, people who'd worked with Pol Pot, people who had themselves committed terrible things in the course of his regime. One of the things that kept on coming back was they would say to me when I would put it to them, well, didn't you ask yourselves what you were doing? Didn't you ever question what this regime was about? The answer inevitably was, we didn't ask ourselves questions, we just followed. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that was an excuse. They really didn't ask themselves questions, because in Cambodian culture they were brought up not to ask themselves questions.
Exactly. And then, as you write, he was not a great student, but he found his calling in revolution. And you have to wonder how much of that might have been resentment. You know, when everyone else in college was going on vacation, he had to do manual labor in Yugoslavia. He spent many of his early years being on the fringes of power and luxury, or at least observing it, but wasn't part of it.
Well, these are things which are so difficult. You know, you try and get inside a personality. What really makes him tick? I have to say, I think that's probably too easy. I don't believe myself, and it is a question of belief because one can never prove it one way or the other. I don't believe Pol Pot was resentful. I think the things he did sprang much more from what he perceived as was necessary to try to improve the lot of Cambodians. And it, that may seem very paradoxical to put it that way, because what he did, as you've said, is to end up killing or causing the deaths of a million or a million and a half Cambodians, a fifth of his country's population. But that was not how he started. That was not the aim. We all say, you know, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. Mm. Well, that certainly was so with Pol Pot's Cambodia. He really did want to make things better, and he finished up doing absolutely the reverse. Not, I think, because of any kind of deep, you know, psychological fissures or failings, but in part, at least, because he was operating in a society where violence was often perceived as the only way to bring about change, and where there was, above all, this national paranoia about the survival of the Cambodian nation. And I think that's absolutely fundamental. Cambodia is surrounded by Thailand and Vietnam, much larger, much stronger countries. And in all through its history, for hundreds of years, it has felt itself under threat. Well, if it's like a cornered animal, you know, if an animal feels itself under threat, it attacks. It does irrational things. And that, in a way, is what Cambodia did during Pol Pot's time in power. It did irrational things, causing a hecatomb of death.
Well, and one of the things was, of course, emptying out the cities, going after the intellectuals. That seems so surprising because Pol Pot was a schoolmaster, after all.
Absolutely. And if you add up the numbers of schoolmasters who've become dictators of one kind and another, visionaries, I mean, think of Mao, who was also a schoolmaster and saw himself through much of his life as what he really wanted to be above all was a teacher for the Chinese people. Well, Pol Pot had something of the same feeling. And you start off as a schoolmaster and you finish up trying to impose your ideas on an entire nation. But intellectuals, yes, were suspect because they had absorbed ideas of the old culture, and Pol Pot wanted completely to remake Cambodia's culture. The evacuation of the cities was partly practical. It was partly the idea that the Cambodian communists would not be able to control the urban population, who were seen as holding views very different from their own, unless they were broken up and scattered in the countryside. And partly, again, it's this paranoia about the powerful neighbors. The idea was that everybody should be sent to work on the farms, to grow rice, going back to a sort of very basic agrarian economy, in order that Cambodia could start from the grassroots up, building up its strength in order to resist its neighbors. Well, like so much that Pol Pot did, that proved a total failure, but the idea was initially to make Cambodia strong, to build itself up against Vietnam and Thailand.
That's a fascinating premise that peasant living can be purifying. Where do you think that came from?
Well, it is, but it's a fairly common premise. You know, again, you look at Mao's China. Learn from the peasants. We should be as one with the peasants. Pol Pot didn't get it from Mao, but the certainly in Cambodia, 90% of the population is and was peasant, they were held to incarnate, to be the incarnation of the, you know, fundamental pure values of the Cambodian nation. Remember, these young men, Pol Pot and those with him, studied in Paris. And what did they read in Paris? Well, they read the 18th century French philosophers. They read Jean-Jacques Rousseau, who wrote about the noble savage, who was the philosopher of the idea that peasants and unlettered people from the countryside are the incarnation of the true values of a society. And certainly that influenced this group of people, and it tied in with Cambodian culture, which also, in a certain sense, holds that the peasantry are the incarnation of true Cambodian values. So all these things played in together and became a very kind of potent and explosive mixture.
Mm, so if those people had just been out plowing instead of reading books, they would have been better off, essentially.
Now, well, a little learning is a dangerous thing, and I think that that certainly was true of the Cambodians. They cherry-picked. The students in Paris, and indeed later when they went back to Cambodia, they didn't try really to build a coherent vision of the world. They picked one idea here from Stalin, another idea from Mao, another set of ideas from the French Revolution, and what fitted in with their aims, their desires to do things in Cambodia, they took. But they didn't really think about making it all hang together in a coherent framework. And that was when Pol Pot came to power. This was one of the problems, because he tried to implement extremely simplistic policies. The abolition of money, for example. Cambodia is the only modern state which has tried to do without money when the communists were in power. And it's horribly simplistic. No money, no capitalism. Well, yes, of course, but the cure is worse than the disease, because not having money, not having a society in which there is any kind of exchange of values and commodities, leads you directly to a slave state, which is fundamentally what Pol Pot created in Cambodia, the first true slave state of modern times.
And you describe that very, very tellingly on page 326. There are two paragraphs in which you show how that played out. I wonder if you would read those for us.
Illicit love affairs were punished by death. Women wore their hair short in a regimented Maoist bob with shirts buttoned to the neck. At work, the sexes were segregated regardless of age. Sport was banned as bourgeois, so were children's toys. There was no free time. The only reading materials were two-party journals, which were exclusively for cadres, and a fortnightly newspaper, Padivat, Revolution, which circulated within the ministries in Phnom Penh. The Buddhist wats, formerly the center of village life, were closed. Some were demolished, as the Catholic cathedral had been, to recover the iron struts that reinforced their concrete frames. Others were turned into prisons or warehouses, much as Cromwell's new model army in 17th century Britain had turned the churches into stables. Because they lived on charity, the monks were regarded as parasites. In Khmer Rouge terminology, they breathed through other people's noses. Along with expatriate intellectuals and officials of the Republican regime, they were designated a special class, a singularly un-Marxist category, and within a year had been defrocked and put to work in cooperatives or on irrigation sites. In short, everything that had given color and meaning to Cambodian life was comprehensively suppressed.
Philip Short, that is such a powerful sentence, that everything that had given color and meaning to Cambodian life was comprehensively suppressed. It sounds as if even without the murders, it would have been a very gray, boring place to be.
It was a terrible place to be, and terrible in ways that I don't think any of us can imagine, because we haven't lived through it. The simple thing of not having money, it to us that would be incomprehensible, that there is no, we take it so for granted that there are little spaces for free choice at every turn in the lives we live. We can buy this, or we can buy that, or we can think about buying it. In Cambodia, there was none of this. There was none of that choice. I think the only way you can look at it is as a state of true slavery. And it is something which has not existed in that literal sense in recent times, except in Pol Pot's Cambodia.
Well, and even beyond slavery, it strikes me that what they were trying to do was to eradicate an essential part of being human. You know, not just private property, but anything perceived as me or mine, my husband, my wife, my child, my house, whatever, you know, whether it was a relationship or personal property.
Well, this is where we get very close to something which is a lot of people find very difficult to accept, and that is the role of Buddhism, of Theravada Buddhism, in coloring Pol Pot's thinking and the thinking of the Cambodian communist movement generally. Because what you've just been describing, yes, it's a description of Pol Pot's policies, but it's also, in large part, a description of the goals of Theravada Buddhism. If you are a Cambodian Buddhist, then you do try to demolish your individuality. You try to you believe certainly that your individual personality is the root of all evil. It causes desires and it must be repressed in a very nihilistic sense. As a Buddhist monk, you cut off your relations with your family, with your friends. You try to renounce mental attachments. You take a new name. You leave your old name behind. You leave all material possessions behind. And all these things played in to Pol Pot's vision of communism. It wasn't even a Marxist vision in many ways. It was a communist vision, but very heavily colored by the Buddhist beliefs, which he and all Cambodians absorbed as children when they grew up in the villages and went to the Buddhist wats. And if you think about it, it's pretty understandable. It's pretty natural. Because how do you interpret any kind of alien doctrine? Well, you interpret it in terms of the values that you have absorbed as a child. And that was true in China, where Mao's communism was very heavily colored by Confucianism, by traditional Chinese thought. It was true in Cambodia. And it's one of the factors, one of the elements, which gave Cambodian communism its very special and very terrible absolutism.
Where do you draw those lines then? Because I think most Westerners think of Buddha's philosophy as being very benign.
This
seems to be it brought to the most extreme extent. Is it that people who choose to be Buddhists, who choose to live that life, fine, that's their choice. But in this case, it was being imposed on people against their will?
Well, of course it was being what Pol Pot imposed was totally against people's wills. But you say Buddhism very benign. Yeah, well, Christianity is very pacifist. You know, turn the other cheek. This is the religion of pacifism par excellence. But how many terrible wars, bloody wars, have been fought in the name of the Christian religion? Every coin has two sides, and Buddhism has two sides. Also, there are many different kinds of Buddhism, just as there are many different kinds of Christianity. Cambodian Buddhism, which is very heavily influenced by animism, it's a pretty special kind of Buddhism. So, yes, I'm not in any way impugning the compassionate virtues of Buddha any more than I would be saying that songs like "Onward, Christian Soldiers" are an affront to the Christian idea of pacifism. They are complementary. They are, you know, different faces of the same coin. And Pol Pot took those parts of Buddhism, and he, not just him, but the whole Cambodian communist movement, which had, you know, really large numbers of members. This was not a tiny thing. It was a large swathe of society. They took those aspects of Buddhism unconsciously, not as a conscious thing, but they just absorbed it into the way that they structured their system of communism. And if they hadn't, if you think about it, it would never have resonated with the Cambodian people, because it would have been an alien implant. By giving it a Buddhist coloring, Pol Pot and those with him made communism, his form of communism, resonate. He made it relevant to Cambodian minds.
And then, of course, reinforcing it with hunger and lack of sleep and long hours of labor.
Absolutely.
That'll make people acquiescent.
No, we talked about this, you know, the slippery slope into evil. This was a truly evil regime, which appropriated itself to itself ideas, Buddhist ideas, among others, which were good, essentially good, and turned them on their heads.
We're going to continue in just a moment. Philip Short, stay with us. Hold that thought. We're going to be back with Philip, who is author of a detailed new biography of Pol Pot, as we take a new look at the life and legacy of the dictator behind Cambodia's killing fields. There's more to come after we take a break. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we'll be right back. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking this hour about Pol Pot as we take a new look at the life and legacy of the brutal dictator and mastermind of Cambodia's killing fields. Our guest is longtime foreign correspondent Philip Short, author of a page-turning new biography, Pol Pot, Anatomy of a Nightmare. Philip Short, I want to just pick up on the point we were making as we went into a break about how he was able to get so many people to follow him into what he saw as this new society of equity and justice. But in fact, you have to imagine that a lot of that came because people were just too exhausted and too hungry to fight it.
That was part of it. But I don't think one should underestimate the numbers of people who, during the war, which brought Pol Pot to power, actually bought into his vision. You know, very large parts of the intellectual community, if you like, the progressive intellectuals, the left-wing intellectuals in Cambodia, believed that Pol Pot held out the only vision that could help their country. And they went and joined him in the bush. So did very large numbers of students, huge numbers of peasants, and so on. You can't. One of the problems of Pol Pot, it would be so comforting if one could simply say, well, this was, you know, a maniac, a monster, who in some strange way managed to bend a whole country to his will, a reluctant country, a country which hated what he stood for. It wasn't like that. He had a very substantial following. And what is even more terrible is that if you talk to people in Cambodia today, you will find people, not a majority certainly, but you will find individuals, even those who lost family members, who suffered under Pol Pot's rule, who lost children in some cases, who lost siblings, who will say Pol Pot made terrible mistakes, but he was a great patriot. Now, it's almost unbelievable, but they will say that. So he did respond to something which lay pretty deep in the Cambodian identity. And I think above all, what it was this sense that Cambodia has a unique identity and it has to struggle against its neighbors. This goes terribly, terribly deep. And without that, I think it would be impossible to explain or to try to understand how he came to power, why he came to power, and was able to do the things he did.
Well, and also in terms of who else might share some responsibility here, let's talk a minute about America's role, because you say that without American involvement in Indochina at that time, that someone like Pol Pot would not have been able to rise to power or certainly to hold on to it if he had been able to. How so?
Well, I think I was asked this by a student, a Thai student, at a lecture I gave, actually in Boston, in Boston, her parents had been Thai Communist Party members. And she said, so much of what you're saying about Cambodia in the 1970s is like Thailand. Now, why didn't it happen in Thailand? And it's a really good question, because a lot of people thought in the mid-1970s that Thailand would go communist in the same way. And this was not, you know, just scary talk. There were really strong reasons to think that. It didn't. Now, why did Cambodia go and not Thailand? And frankly, the reason is that the U.S. intervention in Vietnam destabilized the whole of Indochina. It didn't destabilize Thailand. And had Indochina, had Cambodia not been destabilized in that way, the Cambodian communists could not have come to power. Now, the U.S. was not the only country responsible by any manner of means There were lots and lots of other factors, lots of other elements involved. But it was a pretty important factor, this fundamental destabilization, which was born of the attempt to draw a wall against communism, to stop the advance of communism. And in fact, it did the reverse. It failed big time, and opened the door for what was surely one of the worst abominations of the last part of the 20th century, the Pol Pot regime, to come to power.
Which also raises the question of, well, where was the rest of the world once word began getting out about the killing fields? I mean, was there anything you can imagine that could have gotten the United States, for instance, back into the area after it finally got out of Vietnam?
No. No, absolutely not, because you've got to think of two things. First of all, in the minds of a substantial part of American opinion, and certainly a world opinion at that time, the Vietnamese and the Cambodians had been the victims of American intervention. There was a lot of sympathy for the Vietnamese and for the Cambodian communists, and there was simply no public opinion which was willing to accept that these people who had been portrayed as the victims of American bombing and all the rest of it were now about in the process of doing really awful things. For the U.S. administration, likewise, even if they had been convinced that terrible things were happening, the last thing they wanted to do was to get back into this quagmire. Quagmire is the word that they just managed to drag themselves out of.
Mm.
And, you know, there are lessons here, because we tried, I say we, the West, the U.S. in particular, but the West in general, tried to confront what was then the great perceived enemy, communism, and to stop it in its tracks in Vietnam, and we failed terribly. Now we have another perceived enemy, radical Islam. And are we about to go through the same mechanisms all over again and make the same mistakes? I sincerely hope not. But one way of avoiding making the same mistakes would certainly be to look more attentively at what went wrong last time.
Well, and also the unintended consequences of good intentions.
Well, which applies on both sides. There's a neat parallelism there, because Pol Pot had good intentions as a young man, as a student in Paris, and look what happened. He finished up causing the deaths of a huge proportion of his fellow citizens. The U.S. had good intentions in trying to stop the advance of communism, which was rightly seen as a very undemocratic, dictatorial, inhuman system. What happened? We didn't stop it. It made matters worse, at least for a considerable while.
Remind us what finally happened to Pol Pot.
He died. And you may say about time too, but he didn't die in the way that many people would have wished him to die. In 1998, he had been finally still in the bush in Cambodia, still fighting a guerrilla war against the government in Phnom Penh. He had been overthrown, if you like. He'd been deposed by his little group of remaining comrades, and was by then quite sick. He was put under house arrest for the last 9 months of his life, and one night he went to bed and had a heart attack, dying peacefully in his sleep. Not murdered, not committing suicide, not doing any of the things he was alleged to have done. He died very tranquilly, very serenely in his sleep. And that is the end of his story.
Well, I hope this is not an impossible question for someone who has spent years of his life and written a multi-hundred-page book. But is there a particular story from that time that lingers most in your mind?
The stories are of that. It's not. I couldn't honestly say to you there is a particular story, but there are people that I met. There are in many cases people who supported Pol Pot, who suffered terribly as a result of their support. And I'm thinking of one man who now he's a very idealistic man now in his 60s. Who lives in a village south of Phnom Penh, who described to me how his two children had starved to death under Pol Pot. And he was one of those who said, but Pol Pot was a great patriot.
Hmm.
It's that kind of contradiction which hangs in the air in Cambodia, and it's very difficult to get rid of.
Give us a sense of what Cambodia is like today.
Well, I said very difficult to get rid of. Cambodia today, alas, is under a government which is still headed by former Khmer Rouge. The Prime Minister is a former Khmer Rouge. Maybe three or four out of the top six leaders were former Khmer Rouge, in other words, former followers of Pol Pot. It's a very corrupt regime, a very dictatorial regime, where there is no sense at all of justice or the rule of law. Very, very slowly, life is improving for the people. I certainly wouldn't want to say, you know, this regime today is as bad as Pol Pot's. It's nothing like as bad as Pol Pot's. But life is improving there so slowly. And the outside world, really, it's as though Cambodia has had its 15 minutes of fame. The West, the U.S., the other aid donating countries are not really exerting any pressure on the Cambodian government to clean up its act. So improvement comes very, very slowly.
Philip Shore, thanks so much for opening a window to that world for us.
Thank you, Gail.
Philip Short joined us from the south of France. He is the author of Pol Pot, Anatomy of a Nightmare. You can continue the conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on Forums. In a moment, two Cambodian sisters and their story of survival under the Khmer Rouge. This is On Point. In 1980, Luang Ung came to the United States as a 10-year-old Cambodian refugee, a survivor of years of hunger and violence under the Khmer Rouge. Her older sister, Chu, was left behind in Cambodia. It would be 15 years before the sisters were reunited. Tonight, Luang Ung shares their story of survival and loss from her new book, Lucky Child, A Daughter of Cambodia Reunites with the Sister She Left Behind. Here she remembers how she felt on April 15th, 1998, when she first heard the news that Pol Pot had died.
It just angered me so much that the world went on and Pol Pot died, and the pictures the media showed of him were of this grandfatherly old man who, you know, was described as kind and charismatic and patient. And yet if I could have reached my hands into the television screen and wrapped my fingers around his neck, I would have done it. I would have squeezed the life from him. It saddens me that Pol Pot died and the information would die with him of what happened to my family, my country, the 2 million Cambodians who died of a population of 7 million. Because we have yet to see a tribunal. Because none of the Khmer Rouge architects have yet been punished for their crimes against humanity, war crimes, and genocide. And on April 17th is also my birthday. When I turned 35 years old this year, 30 years of that was spent surviving wars. From 1975 to 1979, when we went through the Khmer Rouge horrors and genocide, when my father was taken away by the soldiers, I slept in my sister's arms and cried. When my sisters died from starvation, it was my sister Ju who I went to and cried with. So we were very, very close. And after the war, my brother Ming knew that we had to get out of Cambodia to find a better life. There was no economy. There was no government. It was a dangerous place in Cambodia back then. And he could only find enough money and gold to take one sibling with him. He had to choose one of the four. And he chose me. At that moment, my heart broke because I didn't think about leaving Cambodia and going to America and having a better life. All I could think about was that I had to leave my sister, my kindred spirit. And I did. And I didn't get to see her again until 1995, 15 years later. This passage in the book deals with my sister's superstition. And I think it's more than superstitions because it's also her post-traumatic stress from the war. And it was so painful for her. The only way she could deal with the trauma was to deal with it in a superstitious way. Before the rain comes, the waters is at its brownest and murkiest. It is now May, and still the rain gods have not turned the white clouds into thunderstorms. Above Ju, the sun continues to burn and dry up into small holes. Ju now has to travel an hour out of the village to the deep pond to gather the family's water. When she arrives, she climbs out of the cart, unties the cow, and leads them to the muddy water. When the cows have their fill, Ju ties the wagon yoke back around their sturdy necks. Ju takes her pail and walks over to the grassy bank of the pond. Even on the short walk from the road to the pond, Ju is careful to step only on the well-beaten path and to avoid crossing over thick shrubs and rice paddies. For as beautiful as the countryside is, Ju knows that beneath the wildflowers, green grass, red dirt, and wetlands are landmines, grenades, bombs, and other tangible remnants of war awaiting her every step. Everywhere she looks, Ju sees ghosts roaming around the village. So many ghosts, in fact, she has lost count. Sometimes at night, she thinks she can hear them weeping in the forest, calling out to other villagers for help. When the moans grow too strong, Ju closes her eyes and shuts them out of her mind. She knows she cannot allow herself to think too much about death. Such a path will only lead her to wonder about Ma, Pa, and how Gik died. Ju knows that only the soldier came and took them away. When she is consumed too deeply by thoughts of their deaths, she becomes like all the other ghosts who wander the world not knowing if they are dead or alive.
Luang Ung is a survivor of the Khmer Rouge and author of the best-selling book, First They Killed My Father. Her new book is Lucky Child, A Daughter of Cambodia Reunites with the Sister She Left Behind. I'm Gail Harris, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.